I want to talk about secular science, and then in the last hour, talk about the Christian view of science. And I want to begin this evening by reading the first line of Clark's History of Philosophy, Thales to Dewey, which I hope you all check out and read soon. I see the last time it was checked out was September of 98. So I hope you all pick this book up and read it soon. This is how Clark begins his history of philosophy. Greek philosophy began on May 28, 585 B.C. at 6:13 in the evening. That sentence is supposed to capture your attention, and it does. How can he say something as outrageous as that, that it began at 6:13 in the evening? Well, there's a story behind it. Greek philosophy, he's saying, began with an astronomer named Thales. And Thales predicted an eclipse. You know, one of the interesting things about science is that it began with the stars. You might think that science ought to begin with something close at hand. But it began with the stars and observations of the stars. And Thales was a Greek astronomer. Of course, they didn't have any telescopes or anything. But he had observed the stars and done his calculations and predicted an eclipse. Now, I'm sure he didn't get it down to the minute. He probably would have been doing a good job if he'd got it down to the month. But he predicted it, and sure enough, the eclipse occurred. And ever since, this has been one of the hallmarks of science, is that you come up with a law or an hypothesis or a theory, whatever you might want to call it, that is capable of being tested, and you make a prediction, and then if the prediction comes true, that is regarded as a confirmation of your law or your theory or your hypothesis. And Thales did this. Thales was an interesting fellow. He got tired of the practical men in Greece criticizing these ivory tower philosophers. So in order to prove that he could make money with the best of the merchants, he went out and he bought leases on wine presses in the region which he lived. And When the grapes were ready for harvest, everybody had to go to Thales and rent a wine press, and he made a fortune. He had the options on the use of the wine press during the harvest season. And he said, see, it's very easy for philosophers to make money, but we think there are more important things to do. And that was his response to the practical men who were criticizing the ivory tower philosophers. Thales was the first, and Thales is spelled T-H-A-L-E-S. In case you're wondering. He was the first of the what are called the nature philosophers. We might call them scientists today as astronomers. He put forth the theory that everything in the universe was made out of water. Now you might say, well, this is very strange, but he observed that water at certain temperatures is a solid, at other temperatures it's a liquid. And at still other temperatures, it's steam, it's a gas. So it seems a likely candidate that if you're going to have one primordial substance, as it were, of which everything is made, water is a good candidate. It exists in three states, solid, liquid, and gas. But the insight here, I think, is more important, not what he chose in thinking that the universe was made up, but the fact that he chose one thing. Of course, we still think the same thing. Our scientists today still think the same thing, you know, 3,000 or almost 3,000 years later. There's still one element, atoms, or if you look at their constituent parts, the electrons or the neutrons or the protons that make up all things. So whether you're looking at gases or liquids or solids, whether you're looking at human bodies or celestial bodies, and no matter what it is you're looking at, they're made up of atoms, according to modern science. Sort of the same insight. that there's one primordial thing that everything is made out of. And, of course, Thales didn't have any microscopes or telescopes, and he never saw a molecule in his life, let alone an atom. But he did think that everything was made out of water. He lived in the 6th century before Christ, if you want an approximate date on Thales. There was another nature philosopher named Anaximander who lived at about the same time. And he also had the idea that everything was made of one, but he was rather less definite than Thales. He called it the boundless or the limitless. And that was about as clear as he got. Then there's Anaximenes, who lived a little bit later than Thales. And he said that everything is air. Everything is made out of air. And Heraclitus, who lived about 500 BC, everything is made out of fire. These men are called monists, M-O-N-I-S-T-S, which means they believe that there is one thing the whole universe is made out of. And finally, perhaps the most influential of them all was Parmenides of the monists. He said everything is the one. Couldn't get more monistic than that. Everything is the one. There were other folks as well. There were dualists, Pythagoras, from whom Pythagoras, by the way, is spelled P-Y-T-H-A-G-O-R-A-S. He's the source, if you've studied your geometry, of the Pythagorean theorem. Anybody know the Pythagorean theorem here? Any students of math? Well, he's the source of many ideas that Plato puts forth in his dialogues. He was a dualist. He thought everything was composed of the limitless and the limit. And in the 5th century, we run into a man named Empedocles. I'll spell that one for you as well. E-M-P-E-D-O-C-L-E-S, Empedocles. He said there are four primordial substances, as it were: earth, air, fire, and water. And everything is made out of those. Finally, there's Anaxagoras. A-N-A-X-A-G-O-R-A-S. Anaxagoras, 5th century B.C. Who said everything is made out of infinite number of seeds. He called them seeds. And at the same time, he's writing, what we call atomism appears. A-T-O-M-I-S-M, atomism. Again, this is a view that is prevalent in the 19th century in science. Everything is made of atoms. Leucippus is the first gentleman, the first scientist or nature philosopher, if you want to use that phrase, that put forth this view. Democritus, Epicurus, Lucretius, they're all atomists. And what the world consists of, according to these men, is atoms in motion. Atoms in motion. The word atom itself comes from the Greek that means cannot be cut. Cannot be cut. These are tiny particles, hard, impenetrable particles that could not be divided. And until Einstein showed us how to divide the atom, that was what people believed about atoms. They could not be cut. These are the early nature philosophers. Some of their insights have controlled philosophy or science, nature philosophy, for the past 2,500 years. But there's an interesting fellow who comes on the scene about 475 B.C. 475 B.C. His name is Zeno, Z-E-N-O. Zeno. He's a student of Parmenides and very much opposed to the atomistic view. matter and motion. And what he wants to do is he wants to show everybody that there are very serious problems with this view of the world. So he's a very clever fellow, and he comes up with paradoxes that are designed to cause people to think about what they take for granted about the world. And one of his most clever stories is a story about Achilles and the tortoise. Maybe you've heard the story of Achilles and the tortoise. Achilles is a very fast runner in Greek mythology. His speed is legendary. But the tortoise, who of course is known for his slowness, his lack of speed, challenges Achilles to a race. Now, the terms of the race indicate that the tortoise is much brighter than Achilles is. Let's assume that this is the race course. Here's where we start, or at least here's where Achilles starts. Now, what the tortoise asked for was a head start. So give me a 100-foot head start. So the tortoise starts here. And he says, "You will have won, Achilles, when you overtake me and pass me. You will have won when you overtake and pass me." So Achilles thought this was a low-risk enterprise here. So he agreed to the challenge, and they begin running their race. Well, the race begins. The tortoise has his head start. Achilles is there back at the starting line. Now, this next line is going to represent what happens as the race progresses. In a few minutes or whenever, Achilles moves up to this point. That is, he gets to the point that the tortoise was at when the tortoise began with his head start. But the tortoise, in that intervening amount of time, whatever it might be, has obviously moved on, however far the tortoise can move in that distance. So the tortoise is here. Well, here's the race course again. Now, Achilles gets up to where the tortoise was at this point in the race. We'll call this Achilles double prime. And the tortoise is no longer there. In whatever small amount of time that has elapsed in Achilles running from here to here, the tortoise has moved on. So the tortoise is right there. Tortoise double prime. Well, we continue here. Beginning and end of the course. Achilles, of course, keeps running. And he gets to where the tortoise is at tortoise double prime. And this is Achilles triple prime. But of course, in the intervening time, the tortoise has moved on. And now the tortoise is here. Now, do you see where this argument is going? In whatever amount, I'm not going to draw any more up there, but in whatever amount of time Achilles spends running and gets to the place where the tortoise used to be, the tortoise has moved on, however small that distance is. That is, Achilles never catches the tortoise. Let's assume he halves the distances between them each time. So the first time he gets halfway there to where the tortoise used to be, but he's moved on. The next time he gets half of that distance again, the gap between them, the next time it's half of that distance again. And you have an infinite series of halves here. That is, Achilles never catches the tortoise. And the tortoise wins the race. Now, for 2,500 years, Zeno's paradox has been baffling philosophers. What's wrong with it? Time? What do you mean? Now, if you sit down and figure it out, let's say Achilles can run 15 miles an hour and the tortoise can do 1 mile an hour. So we simply make a calculation. Now, in 10 minutes, Achilles can run, well, at 15 miles an hour, in 10 minutes, Achilles can run how far? A little over 2 miles, actually. And the tortoise, in that space of time, can run maybe 100 feet. So all we do is a simple calculation, say, well, Achilles is far ahead of the tortoise after 10 minutes. But not quite, because Zeno won't let us do that. He won't say that Achilles can run at all. He will not allow you to say that Achilles can run at all. Because in order to get from here to here, he first has to get from here to here. And in order to get from here to here, he first has to get from here to here. And in order to get from here to here, he first has to get from there to there. And there to there. He has to cover an infinite series of halfway points. And of course, he can't do that. Zeno says, motion is impossible. Motion is impossible. What you take to be motion, and his argument is directed at those nature philosophers who teach that the universe is matter in motion, he says, what you take to be motion is impossible. Things cannot move. Now, through the centuries, philosophers have tried to come up with a response to this. Aristotle himself tackled Zeno's paradoxes and tried to come up with an answer. Most people don't bother. They say, well, that's a nice riddle, but so what? We know things move, so there must be something wrong with it. I mean, just look around you. You can see things moving all the time. Well, let's examine that assumption. I'm sure you've all been to a movie, and you sit there in your seat. You look up at the screen, and what do you see? You see people walking around, cars driving back and forth. You see things moving, right? Does anyone know how a movie works? Nothing is moving on the screen. Nothing moves on that screen. What the film projector does is it projects 32 or whatever the number is, images, different still images per second up on that screen. That's what those big rolls of film consist of. Those different still images. It projects them up on that screen too rapidly for the eye to detect the time interval between those pictures. And when the people in the audience sit there and look at it, it looks like things are moving on the screen. But nothing is moving on the screen. You have one still picture being replaced by another still picture, slightly different position with the people in it. But there's no image that moves from the left side of the screen to the right or back again. Maybe the universe is like that. Maybe it's not just movies. Maybe what we take to be motion is nothing but a sequence of still pictures, as it were. Now, interestingly enough, there's a very famous theologian who lived before the time of movies, who said something very similar to that. Jonathan Edwards, one of the most brilliant theologians in America in the 18th century, he put forward what he called a theory of continuous creation. Continuous creation. He said the universe, the visible universe, is so dependent upon God for its existence that it's continually falling out of existence. And God is continually recreating it. That's where it gets the name of continuous creation. It would probably be better if he called it discontinuous creation. But his argument was the providence of God consists in God's continuous acts of recreating the universe every nanosecond. He didn't use the word nanosecond, whatever it was. But the universe is so dependent, it's not independent at all. We like to think that the universe is independent and self-existing and all of that, but it's not. He says it's so dependent on God that it's continually falling out of existence, and were it not for the fact that God continually recreates it, it would disappear entirely. And what God does is he recreates it in a slightly different fashion than it was a fraction of a second before. So what we take to be a motion, just take a simple example. I'm going to wave my hand across the front here. What we take to be a motion of a hand is actually God recreating of my hand, God's recreating of my hand, tiny fractions of a second all the way along here. And there is no continuous motion at all. There is no motion. There's just a bunch of still pictures. Now, Jonathan Edwards had never been to a movie in his life. But that was his theory of continuous creation. And I'm not saying this is a true theory, don't get me wrong. But I want to impress upon you that motion is an unsolved problem. We take it for granted. We're very practical Americans. Let's forget all this stuff that Zeno brought up about Achilles and the tortoise and his other paradoxes. Let's forget about Jonathan Edwards. We obviously see motion occurring. So let's get out there and drive our cars or fix our cars or whatever has to be done. We cannot attack common sense to the extent of saying that there's no motion. Well, the problem is no one has yet given an account, a rational account of motion. And if there's no motion, of course, then science is nonsense. Because science deals with motion, change. And if there's no motion, then science is nonsense from the get-go, right from the start. There's nothing to explain if there's no motion. In the beginning of his book on the philosophy of science, I urge you to read that one too. I'm sure there are copies out there on the shelves. The Philosophy of Science and Belief in God. Clark makes these comments. He says, "Nothing is more difficult to explain than the simple phenomenon of a marble rolling across the table. Things we take for granted. Nothing's more difficult to explain than that." Or to put it another way, he says, "One of the world's best modern scientists admitted that he was completely baffled by the fact that when he picks up one end of his pencil, the other end comes along with it." Completely baffled by that fact. We take it for granted. But the scientist who thinks about these matters is baffled by it. One of the reasons is, obviously, that according to the scientific view of the world, that pencil is 99.99% space. So why should picking up one end of the pencil take the other end along with it? That's one of the baffling things of science. Zeno gave another paradox. Actually, he gave several. Let me mention one more. He said, imagine shooting an arrow into the air. He says, that arrow appears to move. It leaves the bow and arcs in a trajectory and finally comes down somewhere. He says, but let's define our terms. He says, rest is when two points on any object coincide with any two points in space. So if I have, I hold this notebook perfectly still, two points on this notebook, the top corner and the bottom corner here, coincide with two points in space, this notebook is at rest. Okay. He says, then consider the arrow being shot from the bow. He says, at every moment in time, the point of that arrow and the feather on the back coincide with two points in space. So at every moment in time, the arrow is at rest. So there is no motion. That's our definition of that rest. At every moment in time, they coincide with two points in space. In the new physics, modern physics, you get something really weird going on with subatomic particles. according to the theories of new physics, particles move, to use the word loosely, from one orbit to another within the atom without going through the space in between. They disappear in one orbit and reappear in another orbit. And they do not traverse the space in between. Now, if this is the case, can we say that these particles moved? Let's imagine we're Jonathan Edwards and ask the question, why do we even assume that that's the same particle that disappeared from one orbit and reappears, if indeed it did reappear, and appears in another orbit around the nucleus of the atom? Why do we assume it's even the same particle? Motion is a problem. But we rely on observation. Zeno did nothing but rely on logical arguments. And we have to rely on observation. We can't murder observation. We have to be empiricists. So let's look at empirical science. And again, it doesn't begin with the 19th century or the 20th century. Aristotle was a great collector of information. Aristotle and his students. Aristotle had a love for botany, among other things. And he collected a great deal of information about plants and about animals. And he was interested in just about everything. He and his students collected information on governments. Did a great deal of what we would call empirical research about all these things. Sometimes people have the mistaken idea that the difference between Aristotelian science and modern science is that Aristotle relied on deduction and modern science relies on observation and induction. Not true at all. Aristotle collected enormous amounts of data. Most of it we don't have. Most of Aristotle's works were lost. We have only maybe a fifth of what Aristotle did, and his major works consists of not polished lectures, but notes, and we don't know whether they're his notes or his students' notes. But he was a great collector of information. In the Middle Ages, there were philosophers, nature philosophers, who emphasized going out and observing things. But when we get to a gentleman named Leonardo da Vinci, we see this stated very clearly. And let me give you a quote from Leonardo. He lived at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century, died at about the time of the Reformation. And I'll read you a couple paragraphs about his concept of scientific method. He begins by saying, all our knowledge has its origin in our perceptions. This is the definition of, that I'm going to use of empiricism tomorrow morning when I talk about epistemology. All our knowledge has its origin in our perceptions. Obviously a man unimpressed with Zeno and his paradoxes. Another quote from Leonardo. First, I shall test by experiment before I proceed further, because my intention is to consult experience first and then with reasoning show why such experience is bound to operate in such a way. The major difference between ancient science, exemplified by Aristotle, for example, and modern science is not that Aristotle was deductive and modern science is inductive, but the experimental method. The ancient scientists didn't experiment as a regular program. Perhaps occasionally they did, but they didn't see that as the major research program, the conducting of experiments. In Leonardo, we see the beginning of modern experimental science. He says, I shall test by experiment before I proceed further, because my intention is to consult experience. Continuing with Leonardo, this is the true rule by which those who analyze the effects of nature must proceed, and although nature begins with the cause and ends with the experience, we must follow the opposite course, namely, begin with the experience and by means of it, investigate the cause. Nature begins with the cause and ends with the experience. We start with the experience and investigate the cause. Experience never errs. Experience never errs. It is only your judgments that err. By promising themselves effects such as are not caused by your experiments. The infallibility of experience in Leonardo. Experience never errs. You cannot have a false experience. Then he suggests repeating experiments. He says, before you found a law on this case, that is a certain experience that you have, he says, test it two or three times and see whether the experiments produce the same effects. Leonardo also suggested the combination of mathematics with experimentation. Now, this, again, is not new. Thales had done it 500 years before Christ. But he'd done it with astronomy. Leonardo is suggesting that we use mathematics with things close at hand, not just the stars. He says, there is no certainty in sciences where one of the mathematical sciences cannot be applied, or which are not in relation with these mathematics. Now, Aristotle, when in his scientific researches, did not use mathematics. Thales, of course, and the astronomers did. And Leonardo is advising everyone that unless you use math in the sciences, there's no certainty. If you rely just on prose, just on ordinary language, and then there's no certainty. There you have one of the earliest statements in the modern period of the foundation for modern science from Leonardo da Vinci. Francis Bacon. Let me give you some quotes from the Englishman Francis Bacon. As to how he says you proceed in science. He says, first, we must draw up a list of all the cases we know of in which the phenomenon of heat occurs. So he has proposed the question, what is heat? That's, you start out with a question, such as, what is heat? Then you draw up a list that we know of in which all the phenomenon of heat occurs. And he calls this the table of presence. P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, presence. And then Bacon himself lists 27 cases in which heat appears. The rays of the sun, especially in summer and at noon, the rays of the sun reflected. Fiery meteors, burning thunderbolts, eruptions of flame from the cavities of mountains, all flame, ignited solids, warm baths, liquids boiling, hot vapors and fumes, and so on and so forth. He has a list of 27. That's the first table you draw up in Bacon's method of scientific research. Then you draw up a table of deviation. That is, you make a list of cases which are similar to the first list of cases, but in which the phenomenon of heat does not occur. This is the table of deviation. The sun, the stars, and the comets are heavenly bodies the moon, like the sun, but they don't give off heat. So they belong in the table of deviation. Then you draw up a table of comparison. And this is a list of the instances comparing the first two tables, and so on and so forth. So when you, if you do this Baconian procedure, you end up with a list of observations, and then you try to come up with what is in common here. What is heat? You're trying to answer the question of what heat is. And he says you'll come to the conclusion that heat is motion. I don't mean to bring motion up again, but that's what the physicists tell us heat is. Heat is motion. The motion of molecules. And the faster the molecules are moving, the hotter the the substance is, whatever it might be. So we're back there to motion. But he has all these, what shall we say? I'm sorry? Heat is motion. Heat is the motion of the molecules.
So if I could get you warmer,
you would faster? Are these lectures too long? Well, I don't know if I would or not, but if you apply heat to a pot of water, the molecules move faster.
You said that the motion was heat.
The motion is heat. It's the motion of the flame put in proximity to the water, which increases the motion of the water. Yeah, the two have some effect on each other. It's very difficult. I don't know why the end of the pencil comes up. So.
Flame?
The flame is motion too.
It's actually like resistance and rubbing together.
No, it's not frictional. It's molecules bumping into each other. And it's not. good question. How do we know they're even there? But let's not get into that. That's for the sake of this this class. We all believe in molecules and atoms. Well, anyway, this is Bacon's research program. Now, Bacon did not. Francis Bacon. This is. Did not recommend so much experimental science as actually going out. He was more Aristotelian in that sense, although he says he's not. He says, I'm proposing a new method, a novum organum, a new method for doing science. And he says, what you do is you go out and make all these observations and compare your observations one with another and come up with what's in common. I don't know how that much that differs actually from what Aristotle tried to do, for example, with the constitutions of the governments of Greece. He and his students went out and compared the constitutions to see what they had in common and how they differed. And in that respect, I think his research program was very similar to Bacon's. Any questions? Yes, Reinhard. We've got 2 minutes, so you're going to have to make it fast.
About the atomists in the early Greeks, how did they come to the realization that they have small units that back then they thought were indivisible, but how did they, without instruments, how did they arrive at this philosophy?
Well, The monists before them, you know, the Thales, for example, with water, had already suggested that everything is made out of one thing. So this is not a new insight for them. The new insight for them is their description of what the one thing is, and it's unlike what we see. It's small little pellets that cannot be divided. How the genesis of their idea, I don't know. I can't tell you. Yes, sir?
Did they came from the planets and just thought they go
down? No, I don't think they had any idea of what the planets were.
If they predicted
you can do that. You can observe the motions of these things without knowing what they are. And perhaps, you know, we have this image of the atom in our minds that it looks like the solar system. And maybe they had that idea, I don't know. So, that perhaps the atom is like a miniature solar system. But the atom is impenetrable, undividable, hard, and everything that we see is made up of these things. And all that is, all that's there is space, and they move through space. A very influential line of thought in the history of science. Any other comments or questions? Yes, sir. How does the straw get? I have not read a good explanation of that. If anybody, you know, you hear strange things like that all the time. You know, you hear about things like that whenever there's a tornado. There's something odd like that.